Code Monkey, get up, get coffee. Code Monkey, go to job. Code Monkey, have boring meeting with boring manager Rob. Rob say Code Monkey very diligent, but his output stink. His code not functional or elegant. What do Code Monkey think?
Hello and welcome to From Python Import Podcast. My name is Mike Piernot.
Hi everybody, my name is Dave Noyes. Professionally, I write Python. In my spare time, I like to read comics and read about parasites and nutrition.
Nom 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 nom. All right, so today we're going to be talking about Python 3 at long last with a couple of exciting guests. We have Nick Coughlin and Alex Gaynor to have kind of a consideration of both sides of the Python 3 coin. But first, let's talk about a few things that have been going on. So there is a new Django News podcast that features information, news, and community projects and interviews. Very straight up factual, not as goofy, silly, wonky, crazy as some of the things that we do. But it's pretty good, so you should check it out. It is, let's see, I've got the URL here and we'll have the URL in the show notes. It is at elena.github.io/Django News Podcast. The Elena is E-L-E-N-A, and the Django News Podcast has hyphens in it. And we'll have that in the show notes. But it's pretty good, and if you're into the Django world, you should check that out. The showrunner, Elena Williams, will also be speaking at PyCon this year in Montreal with the Hitchhiker's Guide to Participating in Open Source, which looks like a pretty good talk. So go check that out if you are in Montreal or if you're watching PyCon videos after the fact. So speaking of PyCon, it is sold out, but there are still tutorial spots available. But they're filling fast, so go sign up for some of those. There are also volunteers needed for session running and session chairing. So you can go to the PyCon site, go to the schedule while you're logged in, and you can sign up to session run or session chair one of those blocks of slots, if that's a thing that you are interested in doing. I've done it a couple of times. It's really great. It's a lot of fun. It's a good way to meet people and to give back to PyCon and help make the experience smooth. You can obviously find out more about PyCon at us.pycon.org. There are also many other Python conferences coming up. Way too many to even think about listing. But it turns out that there is a schedule of those at pycon.org, including conferences and user group meetings. So just go to pycon.org, not the us.pycon, but just plain old pycon.org, and scroll down, and there is a wondrous calendar filled with all kinds of exciting Python stuff somewhere near you.
What if you had to pick two?
Oh, man. Well, I wanted to go to Py Tennessee, but the scheduling didn't work out for me at all. And that sucks because I heard it was amazing. And I would want to go to Py Ohio because it's nearby, and it is also really awesome, but I had a vacation scheduling foul up for this summer, and I am actually going to be on a boat then.
Oh no, you're missing Py Ohio?
I know, and it's absolutely killing me.
Well, you'll be on a boat.
Yeah, so...
Fair enough.
Yeah, you can all, you know, shame me on the Twitters. You can do it now. You can do it in the months leading up to it. You can do it while I'm away. If you do it while I'm away, it'll be great, because I won't get any of those tweets.
Actually, I might go just to shame you.
You should do that. You should give a lightning talk at Py Ohio about how I make you give lightning talks at Py Ohio, but then I, like, don't even have the guts to show up.
Excellent. Noted.
Should do that. There's also a lot of really great Python news going on. You can check out PyCoders Weekly. They're at PyCoders.com or at PyCoders on Twitter. There's also at GetPy, G-E-T-P-Y, on the Twitters. And they also tweet all kinds of exciting Python happenings.
Excellent. So
a couple of great ways to stay informed. And rumor has it, there's another Python and technology podcast out there that just came out, called Import This, that one of our guests is involved with. And we may hear more about that later. So speaking of our guests, let's get to it, and let's talk about Python 3 for a little while, shall we?
Let's do it.
All right. All right, so today we're finally going to talk about Python 3, a topic that we've been putting off for several years now. With us today are Nick Coughlin and Alex Gaynor, and we're going to sort of talk about two different sides of the Python 3 coin. Nick is a CPython core developer, a Red Hat toolsmith, and according to his Twitter bio, is a cognitive science dabbler and a cynical idealist. And from what I've seen, he's sort of been de facto public relations for Python 3 lately.
Hey.
Also with us, Alex Gaynor is a core developer of Django, PyPy, and CPython. He's a PSF board member and a software engineer at Rackspace. Recently an author of the Cryptography IO library for Python, and describes himself as the most trusted clueless asshole, a feminist, and a pronoun troublemaker.
Hi.
And I know what that pronoun is about, and I appreciate it, and I am pro-pronouns. Python 3. I have to confess, I'm a bad Pythonista. I use Python 2.6 at work, and so I really haven't spent a lot of time looking at Python 3 or playing with it, because I really can't use it in my production environment yet. So I'm really coming at this from a new perspective, and I would love to know a little bit of history and why I should love Python 3.
I'll start with some of that. I actually use Python 3 in production as well. It's like, all our production stuff is on Red Hat Enterprise Linux 6, and we use the system Python, so 2.6. But anyway, so Python 3 basically came about because back in 06, 2006 or so, Guido basically picked out a bunch of issues in Python 2 that the only way to fix them was to break backwards compatibility. And the thing is, it's aside from the string text versus bytes thing, all of them were just little niggles. Things like division being C-style truncated division and various other things that were... Once you were an experienced Python developer, you kind of just ignored them because you'd gotten used to them and you just didn't do them anymore. Whereas when you're trying to learn it, it was the case of, why is this weird thing here? Why do I have to work around this? And there was no defensible reason for it. It was just that it was a mistake that was made years ago, and backwards compatibility meant we couldn't fix it. And there's a thing that says, a design's not finished when there's nothing left to add. It's finished when there's nothing left to take away. And as Python lasted longer and longer and longer, the natural course of a programming language is for it to get more complicated as you add more stuff, which inevitably makes it harder to learn. So the only way to make it easier to learn again is to take stuff away. And Python 3 did a bunch of that as well, taking old style classes away, taking old syntaxes for doing things away. But all of that breaks running code. And so Python 3 was born as a way of doing that in parallel while continuing to support Python 2. And so Python 2.6 was in parallel with 3.0 and 3.1. Python 2.7 was in parallel with 3.2. And then basically Python 2.7 went into long-term maintenance as we proceeded with Python 3.3 and now with Python 3.4. And so at the moment we've been developing both in parallel for 8 years.
So it's had some history, and it's been well attended to over that time. What's new about it? What's different? What should I be excited about?
From the point of view of an experienced Python 2 developer, there's not a lot really exciting up to and including 3.2. You get a cleaned up version of Python 2 with a bunch of stuff that you shouldn't have been using anyway taken out. The one big thing that I genuinely miss in working in Python 2 is the chained exceptions, and we weren't able to backport those just because of arcane technical reasons in the Python 2 interpreter, that technically the way they work is backwards incompatible. That's every time I see a exception in an error handler in the production logs, it's like, no, if we were using Python 3, we would have got the real exception as well. That's the one thing I genuinely miss. Most of the other stuff that's added in 3.3 and 3.4, again, it's about making it easy to get started, making it easier to learn. Experienced Python 2 devs will generally have already learned out of necessity to avoid the traps that Python 3 just gets out of your way permanently.
What was considered so wrong with Unicode and text and strings that we needed to break backward compatibility?
So the interesting thing there is that, and this is actually something that we learned from the web framework folks and the GUI developers, which is that as people learned more about using Unicode to deal with internationalization issues, the lesson they learned was that you want to treat all your text data as Unicode, and that you want to do the transform from a binary format to text as close to your application boundary as you can, or as close to your system boundary as you can. And they manipulated all this text internally. Basically because while technically you can do raw manipulation with the binary formats inside the app, it's really, really hard. Essentially, you couldn't use the way Unicode works in Python 2 to learn how Unicode works.
Yeah, it is I will say it is a pain in the ass.
Yeah. The affordances aren't there to push you in the direction of doing it right. And that's why the web frameworks and other things had to step in and say, look, don't use the native utilities. Don't use what the language provides you directly. Use the additional infrastructure that's built into the web framework, because they figured out how to do it right. And they kind of pushed you into having Unicode in the right places and binary data in the right places. And so what the text Unicode changes were about in Python 3 was saying, okay, those people have it right, that the designers of the web frameworks and the designers of GUI frameworks, the way they were doing Unicode was the right way to do it. It was the way, and it's also the way Java does it, it's also the way .NET does it.
Okay.
And so Python 3 was basically Guido going, you know what? All those other people are right. Let's make Python 3 work the same way. And then a lot of the interesting developments in Python 3 over the last 3 years have just been 3 years? 5 years?
5 years.
Have basically been about going, okay, we've made this change. What are the consequences? Because it turned out to be, it was the single most profound change that has then taken a long time to ripple out through different parts of the standard library and different things as we go, okay, it sounds like, oh, just make the separation stricter. It's like, oh, that's not hard. And you're going, well, it turns out that fairly profound consequences is there were lots of gray areas where previously we'd just been able to sweep it under the rug and say, it might be binary, might be text. We'll just kind of treat them both the same and hope for the best. And so
now we have an explicit bytes type, right?
Yeah.
And I know that is sometimes a perilous thing for people to understand the distinction or to understand how to work with one or versus the other. What kind of advice do you have?
For Python 2 or Python 3?
For Python 2 people who are moving to Python 3. I think that's probably most of the Python world right now, right?
Yeah.
Except for those lucky people who get to run Python 3 in production because they have totally greenfield things and no dependencies and all that good stuff.
Including the new Python dodo.
Right.
So basically what we've kind of learned is that binary formats are a communications mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're using them either to communicate with other code right now, so network protocols, other forms of inter-process communication. So that's, you need binary data, because fundamentally computers and communications network operate on streams of bits. And you also often need it when interoperating with other languages, so foreign function interface stuff. Then the other time you need it is communicating with your own code in the future, so file formats, that kind of thing. And so for that, you pretty much are always going to have to be dealing with binary data. However, inside an application, you want to be dealing with more structured data types than that. You usually don't want to be manipulating the raw binary data directly, except in the code that is specifically about serialization and deserialization. And so inside your application, you want structured things. You don't want to deal with, I have a stream of Koi-8 encoded text. You want to deal with, I have a bunch of text. You can work that way in Python 2, and the web frameworks do. That they are basically aimed at taking they treat the 8-bit string as this is wire format stuff or the file format.
Okay.
And then they try and get it to the Python 2 Unicode type as quickly as they can. And then they just say, look, just use Unicode everywhere. Don't use 8-bit string, use Unicode. Once you know what you're doing, you can make Python 2 work. The problem with it is that the defaults in Python 2 are wrong, which is that 8-bit string type, it's like, well, it's either arbitrary binary data or it's ASCII compatible text. And the language isn't going to give you any help telling which is which, because it doesn't know. And so what Python 3 aims to provide is, okay, bytes is always arbitrary binary data. But because binary data with ASCII-compatible segments in it is really common, it has a bunch of helper methods that are specific to that use case. If your data is not ASCII-compatible, you can just not use those methods and kind of ignore them.
Okay.
But if your data is ASCII-compatible, they're there and you can use them if you need them. But if you have genuine text, then you decode it to the text type and deal with it as text. That's kind of how it's supposed to work.
You mentioned that there wasn't a whole lot of anything super new, exciting, interesting in 3.0 to 3.2. What's exciting and interesting then, by implication, in 3.3 and 3.4? What new things can I look forward to playing with?
A lot of the cool stuff is actually in standard library modules. And so a lot of those are actually available on the Python package index's backports for Python 2 as well. As I said earlier, a lot of the core developers, we're still using Python 2 in production as well.
Okay.
Because I think that's one of the things that people miss, is that the entire time we've been doing this, we've been working on cycle times where we're making changes in Python that we ourselves won't get to use in production for 2 or 3 years. And so extending a 2 or 3 year forward planning to 3 to 5, it's kind of like, eh, that's not a big deal. Whereas for people that are working on cycle times measured in weeks or months, shifting to a cycle time measured in years just sounds very strange to them.
Right.
Is it possible that maybe Python 3 and its incarnations like 3.2, 3.3, 3.4 turns into something where people that are on 2.6 and 2.7 end up going to a Python 4 and never do anything with 3?
Oh, we're jumping ahead.
Could it? Well, because I was thinking, could it be, because it sounded earlier that you said once Python 3 launched, you guys still had a lot to learn, and you were possibly learning throughout the different iterations of 3. Do you see people definitely going to 3, or there would be another big jump, and that is where it's going to be easier for people to come on board?
No. So one of the interesting things is a bunch of the stuff that got added, or not a bunch of, but some of the stuff that got added to 3 or added back to 3 has actually been about making the common subset of Python 2 and Python 3 bigger. And because it's actually interesting, if you look at Guido's original spec for Python 3, it kind of had two rules. One rule was that single source was not a requirement, that backwards compatibility breaks were allowed. But his other rule was that every single backwards compatibility break had to be justified as making the language better. And so breaking compatibility just for the sake of it was completely out of bounds. And so the combined consequence of both of those ended up being that the common subset of Python 2 and Python 3 actually ends up being quite a usable language. It has a few quirks, but particularly if you can drop support for versions of Python prior to 2.6, it's entirely usable. And that's actually become the recommended migration guide, which is that people with existing Python 2 code generally shouldn't try to jump to Python 3 directly, but instead go through a transition where they're doing Python 3 compatible code on Python 2. And then once that's working smoothly and reliably and has teased out all the mechanical changes that don't change semantics, then what they can do is take that code base that is Python 3 compatible but still running on Python 2, run it with the dash 3 warning switch, which will pick up most of the semantic changes as well, and get rid of those warnings. And then once they have that done, then they can say, well, okay, so this is as close to Python 3 as we can get while still using Python 2. And then they can try running it on Python 3 and say, does it still work? And then that will occasionally pick up a few additional semantic changes. And so David was asking earlier why we kept developing Python 2 in parallel with Python 3. And that was a combination of two reasons. Number one, we knew Python 3 would take a while to catch up to Python 2 in terms of usability because of some of those fundamental changes that needed to ripple out through the standard library. But also it was the case of what it let us do was put a bunch of stuff in Python 2 that's designed to ease the migration to Python 3. So things like the 2-to-3 converter tool, the -3 warning switch, all that sort of stuff. We needed to keep developing Python 2 in order to add that kind of thing.
So would would you recommend, or is it the recommendation that you go as high in 2 as possible before switching over, like going to a 2.7 before you attempt getting your code in
Python? Yes, the jump, trying to go directly from Python 2.5 to Python 3 would just be really, really difficult. Whereas once you go to 2.7, then there's a lot of stuff in 2.7 that was actually backported from Python 3, so...
Is Python 3 a practical choice at this point for production systems, you think?
Yeah, I think so. So in terms of the core language, I think it's actually better, just because we've spent a bunch of the development effort over the last couple of years has been in terms of improving error handling, improving the feedback you get when things go wrong. And as I said, one of the things I miss the most in Python 2 is the fact that if I have a bug in an error handler in my production system, then all I get in my logs is the bug in the error handler. Whereas in Python 3, I'll get both.
That's nice.
This is what went wrong originally, and then your error handler screwed up and changed the exception to something else.
I wish I could say I didn't really want that as a feature, but... I really want that as a feature.
Yes, yes.
I've broken enough of my own error handling code to really think that is pretty cool.
Yes, yeah. It's every time, with the classic one being you get the formatting code wrong.
Right.
And it's like you go, oh, such and such doesn't have this attribute. And you're just going, why was I in that error handler in the first place?
Exactly.
So I'm still very much a Python 3 noob. But from what I'm hearing, would it almost be safe to say that Python 3 and maybe 3.1, 3.2, and maybe even 3.3 was like a Python 2.beta? And maybe where it's at now is like the Python 3?
If you go back and look at like Python 2, I think it was 2.2, I think, was the one that brought in... new style classes, lexical closures, all that sort of fun stuff. So if you go back to 2.0 and 2.1, it's definitely not the modern Python you're used to.
Right.
And so 2.0 was definitely released in a fit of misguided enthusiasm because the IO stack in that was just not usable. It was just way too slow. And so that's pretty much why I think... So 3.0 got one maintenance release, and then 3.1 came out 6 months later saying, okay, here's a version that you can actually use. So 3.1 was usable. 3.2 was the one that Canonical included in an LPS release and basically said, yes, we will give you long-term support for this. 3.3, the big thing that happened in 3.3 was we got rid of a bunch of mechanical noise in doing single source, because 3.3 brought back the U prefix on strings, and that prefix in 3.3 does absolutely nothing.
Right.
it's like it has no semantic effect whatsoever. But what it does mean is that if you are doing single source Python 2, Python 3 code, you can use it, and in Python 3 it gets ignored, but in Python 2 it says this is actually Unicode.
Right.
And so that was it's kind of the classic example of something that we added to Python 3, not to help Python 3 itself, but to help that common subset language.
Sure.
That will run on both.
Now, right before I came back home, I read Alex's post from around December. And I was ready to grab my pitchfork and join the mob. I want to ask, before maybe we can get to Alex, why definitely should I get off of 2.6 or 2.7 and go to 3?
So Alex's post was actually interesting, because people like Guido and I have been saying since the beginning, oh, 5 years until Python 3 is the default for new projects. And we thought that was reasonably clear. And what Alex's post certainly made me realize was that, okay, maybe that's not as clear as we thought, and we need to explain the difference between 5 years to be the default for new projects, where people don't have existing Python 2 code to worry about, versus how long it's going to take before nobody's writing Python 2 code anymore. Because one of these is a much longer time frame than the other. And so...
this is why banks have horrible legacy languages from a million years ago, right?
The banks are still running COBOL on mainframes.
Right. Because I'm sure they'd all love to be running Python 3 also.
Yes, that's right. And so what I realized was that something something I thought had been clear, which is 5 years until it's the default for new project, perhaps wasn't as clear as I thought. And so I started trying to write more in the Python 3 Q&A and what have you, that no, for existing Python 2 projects, there's additional, two different things. There's a difference between never having to learn Python 2 and learning Python 3 first, and then learning Python 2 as a delta from Python 3, which I think is going to be a common learning path for quite some time, just because of the sheer legacy of Python 2 code out there and Python 2 applications. But also that when you have a new project, you can look at Python 3 and say, yes, everything we need is already in Python 3. So we can just use Python 3 and not worry. That's a very different situation from somebody with an existing Python 2 project who has to make business case for spending time and money on getting to Python 3. And so the benefits in there are the fact of, well, okay, Python 3 has been deliberately made an easy language to learn, so it's easy to train new programmers in it. It's, there are certain kinds of mistakes that are quite common in Python 2. A bunch of the stuff we took out of Python 3, it was because we're going, people are always getting this wrong in Python 2. So instead of telling them, don't do that, let's just take it away from the language such that you categorically cannot have that bug in Python 3 because the feature that caused it is no longer there.
Sure.
And so for new projects, that's great. You just can never make those mistakes. For existing projects, you have to say, well, okay, that's great, but we need to make sure we're not relying on that somewhere. So.
Will it cause money to magically appear in my company's accounts? Mm. Because I would really love to sell my bosses on migration, and that would be a really killer feature. Like some kind of Superman 3 penny scheme would be fine with me.
I've just dated myself
horribly.
The main arguments I know on that front are the improved error handling makes debugging easier. A bunch of the work Victor Stinner's done, again, make debugging easier. And then the work we've done to make it easier to learn makes training new hires easier. But unfortunately, none of it's the kind of, we will save X amount of dollars immediately.
Right.
And it's really easy to sell. You need to, you need a management chain that's a bit forward looking. And
right.
How do we, what's the long term cost of the status quo going to be?
All right. So I think it's time we make sure we rope Alex in here. So yeah. you wrote an article called About Python 3.
I did.
And it set the world on fire a little bit, didn't it?
Just a little, though. Just a little.
So you had kind of a less optimistic view of Python 3, or why don't you tell us what you were thinking about? Because it sounded pretty, seemed like it came from a place of some despair.
Yeah, very much sort of this, crushing existential despair. I think first, I think the post was not, because there were several posts that came out after mine that said something very different that I think were very much getting lumped together. This is not a critique of Python 3 and friends, the language. I don't have a problem with the new Unicode model. I like the new text bytes model quite a bit. This is a critique of the Python 3 process, and particularly the process that has resulted in, now 5 years in, us having a version of Python that's used by something like 2% of users. And I think this is problematic, and by analogy, this is the way I like to present this. If we were a company and we released a new version of our product, and 5 years in it accounted for 2% of our revenue, and the old version of our product was still wildly successful, we would have to strongly reconsider what we were doing wrong with our new product, and whether there was any merit in continuing to push forward with the new product. Because we still have this wildly fantastic one we've not been giving sufficient attention to.
I mean, that's even worse numbers than Android. And by the way, I have Android devices, but that's what it made me think of.
So that's sort of where I was coming from when I wrote the post.
Okay.
Do you still have the same feelings a couple months later?
Yeah, I'm still sort of in this crushing existential... The thing that is actually synced in more and more since I wrote the post is the projects I work on, we've spent quite a bit of time porting to Python 3 in the hope that, we would loot our users. Particularly, I'm thinking about the case of Django, where we spent several months putting a really concerted effort into porting to Python 3 and having a good Python 3 story. And, now I wonder what could we have been doing with that time instead? And I think that's, sort of the case you discussed needing to make to your manager, what could I be doing with this time instead? And for me, it's also really problematic. Nick talked about what the development cycle is and the year-over-year development cycle. Continuing to evolve Python 3 as a language without regular feedback from actual users seems really problematic to me.
Right, so there might be bugs or misfeatures or something that go undetected or unaddressed for a long time because you don't have enough eyes on it, enough boots on the ground, as it were.
Sure, like Nick said, the I.O. module in the original 3.0 release was unusably slow. The email module, as far as I know, was not usable due to Unicode bytes issues until 3.2 or 3.3. That was a very common thing for standard lib modules to effectively not be usable until 3.2.
In your post, I see you had some kind words for when people would say, oh, that's in Python 3.4, and when...
Yeah, it's just... No one in this call has Python 3 in production. Telling me it's fixed in a version I can't use is not useful.
Just from the few things that Alex has said, Nick, do you have any thoughts or feelings or feedback to some of that?
Yeah, so the thing is, that from where we're sitting, everything's proceeding according to plan, because the plan was that 5 years, we would have something that could be the default choice for new projects, which is basically Python 3.4. And so all of that stuff Alex is talking about, that kind of early feedback, you don't want. So in marketing, they talk about this thing about crossing the chasm, which is that early adopters are the people that will try out new things, kick the tires, sort out a lot of the issues. Early adopters are very tolerant people. They will cop a lot of flaws in something they're enthusiastic about. And so if you have a new thing that's different from what you've done before, it's the question of if somebody who's in the late adopter, late majority category adopts a product that just isn't ready for them yet, they'll go, this is terrible, I'm never going to use it again, and you'll lose them permanently. And so if you have, as Alex said, a wildly successful current product and you want to try something new, you actually don't want that majority of your user base trying the new thing that isn't ready for them yet. What you're aiming for is to keep the vast majority of your users on your existing product that they're happy with and make sure that continues to work for them and that they can keep doing what they're doing without getting too worried. And then work with the early adopters to make sure that the shiny new thing gets to a state where it is ready for that majority of your user base to start using. And that's what the last 5 years have been about. Working with folks like the web framework community, working with folks like the Linux distros to say, hey, is this ready for you to convert over? And getting that initial set of feedback to get Python 3 back up to the state where it is a language that has all of the improvements that we deliberately designed in from the beginning, but has also had all of the additional limitations, like, for instance, the email module needed a lot of work to cope with a strict bytes Unicode separation. The thing about the Python 2 text model is it is pretty much the POSIX text model with Unicode bolted on the side. That was really, really good for interoperability with POSIX systems. Really lousy for interoperability with anything else. So in Python 3, we changed our text model, which meant Windows interoperability was easier, Java interop was easier, .NET interop was easier, but we made POSIX interop more difficult. And so again, in the last 5 years, we've done a lot of work on fixing a bunch of POSIX interoperability issues. Early adopters will put up with that kind of thing, that they will go, okay, I'll work with this. I believe in where you're trying to get to. I will help you get there. I'll give you the feedback you need. The majority of users won't. They just want something that works. And so when we were saying 5 years to be the default for new projects, it was about getting Python 3 to a point where we were comfortable saying to the majority of happy Python 2 users, yes, Python 3 is better for you now. 3.3 was actually pretty good. And hence Brett Cannon's talk about 3.3 is better than 2.7. It let us do a bunch of stuff that just wasn't possible in Python 2. Like the best example of that is the more efficient storage of Unicode strings. That just isn't practical in the Python 2 code base because Unicode and Stura are so intertwined that cleaning that up is just basically impossible. Whereas in Python 3, Martin von Lowis and a bunch of other people were able to change how Python 3 stored strings internally while still maintaining backwards compatibility at the API level, such that the memory usage of Unicode-capable applications now drops dramatically if you run it in Python 3, or can drop dramatically if the application is particularly Unicode heavy. But what Alex's post made me realize was that we thought it was clear that was the plan, but from outside the core development team, it wasn't clear that was the plan at all. And so what to us looked like everything proceeding exactly as we wanted it to proceed, from the outside looked like a complete disaster, because people were saying, well, but why is it only 2 or 3% of our user base? And it's like, because 2 or 3% of our user base are early adopters. And that now that we've got to a point where we're like going, okay, the vast majority of the issues are addressed, there's still a few that are aimed at Python 3.5, but an awful lot of the issues are now sorted out, it then becomes a case of, okay, this is genuinely a better language. And if you're happy with Python 2, cool, stay on Python 2. But really, it's getting to the point now where the case is starting to become more compelling that using Python 3 is a better idea than continuing with Python 2. The other example in terms of adoption cycles that I tend to use is if you look within the Python 2 series, an awful lot of people upgraded Python in two-step jumps. So like instead of upgrading from 2.4 and then a year and a half later to 2.5, and then a year and a half later to 2.6, then instead, after 3 years, jump from 2.4 to 2.6. And so if you compare that to the Python 3 adoption cycle, so 2.7 and 3.2 were released pretty much together. Mm. But the other thing, both of them were subject to the language moratorium. So we deliberately said we are going to have a release which has no language level changes and only minimal changes to the built-ins. In terms of what's in those releases, an awful lot of it is stuff that you can download from the Python package index if you want to keep using Python 2. So what we didn't communicate very well was the people who were involved in all the Python 3 discussions have been present on the Python 3000 mailing list, have been present on Python Dev for years. We all knew what the plan was. Sure. But if people hadn't been closely following all that,
they'd go,
oh, this looks like a disaster.
Right. So, Alex, what effect has this had on the community to have this long transition period?
I think the biggest impact we can see is sort of that in the same time period of Python 3, the 2.7 release came out, I want to say something like a year and a half after 2.6. So that's about 3.5 years in. At this point, it has, based on the Python package index download statistics, about 75% of the market share. And so looking at that number, the thing I'm compelled to realize is that for the majority of Python users, there's an expectation that every couple of years they'll get a new Python and it'll get better, and they will use whatever the default Python on their Linux desktop or their OS X laptop or the Linux server they deploy to or whatever is. And so for the majority of Python users, Python has not gotten better over the course of the last 3 years or so since Python 2.7 came out. And I just from speaking to friends across the industry, I see that a lot of them are spending more time looking at other programming languages than I think they would be otherwise.
Do you think, Alex, if the communication was better, would it have maybe made the perception and people's acceptance of what's going on better, or would it have still been too long? Because it sounds like from what Nick is saying that for those guys, it's actually going according to plan. Do you think that even if the communication was better, you would still... How would you feel about the plan then?
No, I think the Python 3 plan is still fundamentally problematic in that it divides users into these two classes which are far too broad. And I think it makes an assumption... it makes two assumptions, I think, that are not accurate. One is about sort of the rate of churn for Python projects, which is to say, I don't think many existing Python 2 projects will be rewritten anytime soon or ported anytime soon to Python 3, simply because that's a bridge too far. That's an investment too great with too little return. And I think the other assumption it makes is that, sorry, I lost the train of thought.
The assumption amongst the core development team is that the vast majority of Python 2 projects will never be ported to Python 3. That it just, there will be tons and tons of cases where it doesn't make economic sense to port a perfectly functional Python 2 application to Python 3. People still write new COBOL today Python 2 is a decent language. If it works for you, cool. If it doesn't work for you, then we have tried to make it so that the easiest exit path from Python 2 is to Python 3. Because one of the things people need to understand about how open source works is developers will only do stuff that makes sense to those developers. And when we hit Python 2.7, we basically got to the point where we were going, how many interesting things can we still do with the Python 2 CPython code base? And it had just got to the point where the volume of technical debt in that code base was unmaintainable. There were things that just could not be done without clearing out the legacy stuff. But the problem with clearing out legacy stuff is you then get to a point where you're going, well, hang on, to remove that, we have to break backwards compatibility. So then it becomes a case of, well, okay, if we're going to break backwards compatibility, how do we avoid becoming the next Perl 6? And people have made the comparison, oh, Python 3 is the next Perl 6. And you're going, well, no, because we can actually point to people running Python 3 in production. You can get commercial support for Python 3. But I think going into this, what a lot of people didn't understand was the true enormity of what we were trying to do. I mean, the core development team understood. And Alex is quite right that a commercial operation that is focused on near-term profitability is almost never going to attempt a transition of this magnitude just because the commercial risk is enormous. But what people often forget is that Python wasn't born to make people commercially successful. Python was born out of an education language. And certainly my perspective, and I think the perspective of a bunch of other core developers, that Python 2 is just fundamentally too hard to learn. And the only way to make it easier to learn is to take stuff away and to fix problematic defaults. And that's what Python 3 does, is it changes a bunch of the default behavior to be more sensible, and it takes away legacy stuff that you don't need anymore. But both of those kinds of changes are backwards incompatible. You cannot do them without a backwards compatibility break. And that's what Python 3 represents.
You said it was never born to make people commercially successful. It was born out of a math or a learning type of language. Would you advise people in the commercial industry to not necessarily make a bet on Python?
What I would advise people in the commercial industry to do.
I've got to ask that question.
So keeping in mind that I do work for a company that part of what we offer is commercial Python support, I would advise if a commercial operation has a critical dependency on an open source project and they are not directly investing in that project, either by providing developer time or by paying a vendor, they have a serious problem with poor risk management. Because if you are not a member of a community or you are not paying a vendor that is a member of that community, then you have absolutely no control whatsoever over the future direction of the project. And so one of the points I raise in regards to Python 2, so Red Hat 7 beta Red Hat Enterprise beta 7 has been released. The system Python in that is Python 2.7. And given the life cycle of Red Hat versions, that means there will be commercial support for Python 2.7 until at least 2023. Python 2 developers are not being left in the lurch. They will have access to supported versions of Python 2 for at least another decade.
So we're not going to be Windows XP'd anytime soon.
Yeah. So essentially the situation we have is that people, by the time we end of life Python 2.7 in 2015, this is the community level of support. The Python 3 projects started seriously in 2006. So that's 9 years of free support for a version that is no longer the main focus of the language. So 9 years of parallel development for free. After those 9 years are up, there'll be at least another 8 of commercial support. So 17 years of the legacy version being supported, with the first 6 of those having new features being added. So people can go, oh, well, that's not good enough. And you're like going, seriously?
Nothing is good enough for anyone. Everything is amazing. No one is happy.
Also, yeah. I want to throw out there real quick, Nick. I definitely don't want to bash Python. I love it, and I want to keep writing it for a while. I just felt that was a type of question to maybe get out there.
I may have looked at other languages, but they meant nothing to me.
Yeah, so I'll put it out there. I love Python, and I want to be with it for a while.
So to sort of jump back into to where I was before, remembering what I was thinking, I think the other problematic assumption is that this divergent paths where it's okay that the majority of existing code will never be ported, I think that is very problematic. I mean, if we just start to think it through, what does that look like? Right now, it looks like a lot of open source, something like 70% of the top 200 packages have taken an approach of supporting both 2 and 3. And what does it mean if the majority of our existing users never port? I'm thinking, wearing my Django core developer hat, if you're telling me Instagram and Pinterest and the Washington Post are never porting their code bases, I'm never dropping Python 2 support. And I'll tell you, a year ago, I wrote a message to the Django developers list asking the question, when should we drop Python 2 support, advocating a timeline that I think at this point would have us dropping Python 2. And looking back, I don't know what I was thinking, because it would mean leaving all of our biggest users in the dirt. If no open source project will ever drop 2, there's no point in greenfield developers not using Python 2, because using Python 3 does mean you're entering something of a landmine, or a minefield in terms of your dependencies, because 70% is ported, 30% is not, and I believe that the rate of unported stuff increases as you get into less popular stuff, where less popular things means you're MySQL driver. There's no reason to expose yourself to that risk to this day, and so we've got this cycle where there's no incentive to ever move, and people who are concerned about their existing users will never drop that support.
So a comment Alex actually made a while ago was that you write code either for the users you have or for the users you want.
Yeah.
And so this also gets back into David's earlier question about why was Python 2 development continued for so long. Any continued Python 2 development is about writing code for the users we have. Python 3 development is about writing code for the users we want. And this again gets back to the thing of Python 2 being too hard to learn. What we needed the Python 3 ecosystem to get to was a point where enough stuff was ported that you could reasonably start a new Python 3 project and not have to port anything. One of the big holes was Twisted, which Brito Van Rossum filled with async.io. We're also working with the Twisted guys. They have one major blocker preventing them from porting to Python 3, and that will almost certainly be fixed in Python 3.5. But it's the case of, if you have a new greenfield project or you are trying to learn Python for the first time, start with Python 3. If you find later that there is something you need on that's only on Python 2 and you can't easily port it, or you get tasked with maintaining an existing Python 2 application, then learn Python 2 as a follow-on to Python 3. So learn Python 3 first, then learn Python 2. Because a lot of the habits that are native in Python 3 will stand you in good stead in Python 2 as well. Because Python 3 is basically the people who created Python 2 fixing all the broken bits and saying, this is a better way of thinking about software.
It's like learning modern English first and then going back to more archaic forms of the language.
Yeah, but the other thing is that when I said earlier that if you are already an experienced Python 2 developer, then you will have all of the habits that Python 3 will teach you. You have hopefully already learned the hard way from bitter experience, and that all those minefields that are there in Python 2 just aren't there in Python 3 anymore. And so from the point of view of a beginner trying to learn programming or trying to learn Python, they definitely want to start with Python 3 just because all of those ugly edge cases are just not there, and they can get up and running and be productive and do things.
Okay.
And then the other thing too is that because one of the big things with Python 2 is that its Unicode support is pretty bad, once you get out of the English-speaking world, it's not even a question of why does Python 3 exist. It's like, Python 3 exists because Python 2's Unicode is broken. Okay, that makes sense. We'll use Python 3. And so it's the case of the number of current Python 2 users is such a tiny fraction of the total global possibilities for Python users that absolutely Python 3 is written for the users we want, far more so than it is written for the users we have. The stuff we write for the users we have is continuing maintenance on Python 2, migration support from Python 2 to Python 3. Python 3 is written for the users we want. So it's written for community educators. It's written for people whose primary language isn't English. It's extending the reach of Python to whole new classes of users that Python 2 will just never reach because the fundamental architecture isn't there to do it.
I wanted to ask Alex real quick.
Sure.
I know definitely you have frustrations, but I'm curious about when you did port Python 2 to Python 3, how was the process? Did you feel it was amicable? Did you feel it was decent, or was it really, really tough?
Honestly, if you sort of thoroughly internalized both the Python 2 and Python 3 languages the way I have, it's not particularly difficult. It's fairly boring. I'd like that time of my life back. But having now ported many projects and continuing to port projects, it's not difficult. It's just mind-numbing, frankly.
I was just curious, because, I mean, I know, you know, we've had some differences of opinion on here, but people who are like, all right, there might not be a huge business case, but I want to stick with Python, I want to get to 3, it's not going to kill them going from 2 to 3.
No, I mean, on the other hand, we took a couple months to port Django, you know, obviously in a handful of volunteers' spare time. When I think about my previous company where we had a couple hundred thousand lines of Python, I cannot even begin to imagine where I would start putting together an estimate of how much work that would be.
We have calls to stir all over our universe.
Right.
Not that that is a great thing or a bad thing necessarily, because it was the thing to do at the time when we needed to do it or things got built the way they were, but oh my God, is it going to be terrible to root that all out?
Yeah, this is where I think the Linux distros doing the port is interesting, because if they can port, I suspect anyone can.
Sure.
But it's also the case of why I say that for a bunch of existing applications, the option of staying on Python 2 is going to be there for a very long time. And that what I think we will see is the Linux distro shifting is going to be a big deal, because once they shift, then the users Alex was talking about who just use what the distro provides by default, well, they're all going to become Python 3 developers. I suspect that just as for a very long time, the requirement to support Python 2.4 was pretty much driven by the fact that CentOS 6 didn't exist yet. And so people wanted to support CentOS 5, and then CentOS 5 only had Python 2.4, and so people needed to support all the way back to 2.4 to support their CentOS users.
That sounds very familiar.
Yeah. Hey, I have to write stuff that still runs on RHEL 3. People don't get to complain to me about supporting old software. Oh, wait, no, RHEL 3's end of life, I think. So, yay, RHEL 4! anyway, a lot of the how far back do you have to go comes from those older platforms where people are trying to use the system resources. And so putting my Red Hat hat on for a moment, Red Hat recognizes this is a problem. And so that's where you see stuff like CentOS becoming a Red Hat-sponsored project. So CentOS 7 shouldn't take as long as CentOS 6 did. And the stuff around software collections is about making newer language runtimes available for older versions of Red Hat platforms. And so you can get Python 3.3 support from Red Hat. You can run Python 3.3 applications in our online stuff. So that's the thing where getting from the upstream early adopters who have been wonderful in supporting Python 3 and people like Alex getting stuff like Django ported over. The Twisted guys, even though they haven't been able to port yet, at least talking to us about what's preventing them from finishing their port. That's the kind of layer where we're at now, is we've moved on from saying, okay, what's missing in Python 3 itself? We've moved on from that to saying, okay, how do we build out that same infrastructure level support that we had around Python 2? And so we have Ubuntu LTS about to come out that has Python 3 as the default Python. Oh, sorry, Python 3 as the only one installed on the live CD. We have Fedora actively working this year to try and get to Python 3, where that's the only one on the Fedora live CD. We have commercial Linux vendors offering supported versions of Python 3. That's the kind of layer where we're at now, is building out that same ubiquity that Python 2 had for the Python 3 ecosystem. But I think that's where the miscommunication happened, which was people heard Python 3 as the default for new projects within 5 years. Okay. And thought Python 3 is the default everywhere within 5 years. And that's not what we meant, because that second phase of saying, okay, getting these other ecosystems where Python 2 is currently the default moved over to Python 3, particularly the more conservative ones. The point we're at now with those is where those communities are actually saying, okay, this is the forward direction. This is where we're going to go. We assumed people understood the timeline and so didn't explain it. But if people weren't around back in 2006, that assumption, as it turns out, has not been valid, that there's an awful lot of people who didn't quite grasp the magnitude of this change and the magnitude of the timeline.
I want to pick Alex's brain.
Yeah.
A little
Go
bit.
Go for it.
So what do you see as the way forward? We've heard the sort of the official, here's what the support story is, here's the future for Greenfield development, and either you port or you leave in place the old stuff and you do your new things on Python 3. What do you see as the way forward? How does the community come back together?
I strongly believe the CPython developers should reconsider the decision not to make a Python 2.8. There's been several volunteers on the Python developer mailing list, including existing core developers who volunteered to maintain it. I think that would be a very positive direction, particularly if it included valuable deprecation warnings that Python 2.7 does not have, including on basic things like str.encode or unicode.decode, mm-hmm. which are basically just minefield operations.
Adding new Python 3 warnings is allowed in 2.7 maintenance releases.
Sure. I also, frankly, think it would be valuable to continue backporting features as 2.7 backported dictionary and set comprehensions, for example. I think it would be valuable if there was a 2.8 release, which included things like the non-local keyword and yield from.
So basically trying to make that common subset of the two languages and be as broad as possible and as interesting as possible.
Absolutely.
And make it accessible to people who are heavily invested in 2. And it would be that huge investment to jump from right now from 2 to 3.
Absolutely. I'm not convinced 3 will ever take off, and frankly, I would also like to see 2 be as strong a language as it can be.
As far as 2.8 goes, if you look at my Python 3 Q&A, I basically say the only way I see that happening is as a bought and paid for release. I don't think it's going to happen for free. The CCP guys who make EVE Online are working on a stackless 2.8. And so if that happens, then a CPython 2.8 is certainly more feasible because they will have backported a bunch of stuff already that they think is interesting. But yeah, it basically boils down to that Python 2.8 is, from the existing core developers' point of view, for the stuff we need, the migration path to 3 is good enough and the benefits great enough that we're not interested in doing a Python 2.8 for free. And so the only way that's going to happen is if somebody else does it, if somebody somehow organizes to pay us to do it, which would be challenging, but possible. It's just one of those fundamental things.
Well, let's wrap on Python 3 for this evening, or this morning for you, or it's afternoon now.
Afternoon
now. I've lost track of time zones. We're going to have some other links for people who are excited about Python 3, want to dive in and learn more. There's getpython3.com you can check out. And there's also a really cool tool that Brett Cannon just released called Can I Use Python 3? Worth checking out. And we'll also link to that Python 3 FAQ that Nick wrote, as well as Alex's about Python 3, so that people can check out the discussion there. I wanted to pick Alex's brain a little bit about cryptography.io. Or do I pronounce the dot? Is it just cryptography.io?
So we've been trying to convince people the right way to speak of it in conversation is the full name is pip install cryptography.
Okay, pip install cryptography. Gotcha. So tell me a little bit about it and why you decided it was time for a new crypto library for Python.
Sure. So about 6 months ago, I had a project I wanted to get running on PyPy, which is one of the other hats I wear, and it relied on PyCrypto, which is a C extension and doesn't support running under PyPy. So at the time, there was a project called OpenTLS, I think, that was aiming to be a new crypto library written using CFFI, which is a way to interface with existing C code that runs on both CPython and PyPy. And so I started to get involved in that, and unfortunately, the maintainer was unable to continue working on it. And so I sort of found another group of individuals who were interested in this problem space, and we sort of conceived a bit of a fresh start, calling it cryptography, since the name was available. And as I got into this, at first I was purely motivated by I need enough stuff to, you know, run this application under PyPy. But pretty quickly into the process, I realized most cryptographic libraries have API designs that may as well just be guns for free aimed at your feet and anywhere else on your body. They were incredibly dangerous APIs that made it really easy to do the wrong thing. In fact, the easiest thing you could do when you pick up these libraries is the wrong thing, which to me seemed like a danger far too great. I don't think it's a coincidence that the same time I was getting involved in this, it was also the time the NSA revelations by Edward Snowden were coming out. So I became very passionate about trying to make cryptography more accessible for more developers.
Sure.
So that was sort of the motivation.
Cool. Well, I've played with or looked at playing with M2 Crypto a little bit and been really scared by the fact that I can't make head or tail of it without actually just reading the tests and reading the code. Like the documentation situation is painful. It's not clear to me as a somebody just diving in, like, what do I want to do without hurting myself?
Sure. So this is M2 Crypto is a fairly lightweight wrapper over OpenSSL, and this is a problem that plagues OpenSSL too. It's nearly impossible to understand the APIs or even to read what of the documentation there is without already being a cryptographer.
Right.
We wanted our documentation to be accessible to people who were software developers but not cryptographers. They had a use case in mind. Okay. So that was awesome. A huge motivation for us.
Yeah. So what features does cryptography have now?
The current release of cryptography, 0.2.1, has a fairly complete set of symmetric encryption primitives. So for hiding your data, basically doing encryption where both parties have the same key, you have a fairly comprehensive set of primitives, including some things that are not available in other Python libraries, like a mode or way of doing this encryption that's getting increasingly popular called GCM, which is really popular because it combines authentication, proving who sent a message, with encrypting that message in a way that's possible to implement very, very quickly. So that's something that, as far as I know, we're the first crypto library for Python to have. So we have a fairly complete set of symmetric primitives.
Awesome.
Our next release, 0.3, is going to start having an API for doing asymmetric cryptography. So something, public key cryptography, in other words. So RSA will probably be in our 0.3 release and possibly DSA as well.
Awesome. What kind of time frame do you see that happening in? Because it seems like a lot has come quickly here, which is cool.
We're really fortunate that a lot of very interested people and people interested in volunteering and helping out. I think the 0.3 release will come out, I would guess, probably within the next month or so. And we've sort of committed to doing aggressively time-based releases. So we have this idea that, don't merge a patch ever that we're not ready to put into a release.
Okay.
So right now, our trunk has support for doing signatures and verification with RSA. So I imagine within the next month, we'll probably also have encryption for RSA. And at that point, we'll probably consider a release. And whether somebody has also in that time frame done DSA will determine whether that makes it into the release.
Awesome. Well, that sounds fantastic. I can't wait to start playing with it and hopefully putting it into production and doing good things with it. Thank you for making something that is very much looking like it's not going to suck.
Thank you. No, 6 months ago, I honestly knew nothing about cryptography, so it's been a lot of a learning experience to me in trying to build the library I wish I had when I got started on this process.
Well, what would you recommend for somebody who is completely ignorant about cryptography and is wanting to learn more about it? Because we're always told, there's this abstinence-only kind of education of thou shalt not make thy own cryptography because thou wilt F it up.
Yeah, it's a really common thing. We're all told as we're becoming developers, don't do your own cryptography. If you need to do cryptography, you'll talk to a real cryptographer because otherwise you'll just screw it up. And I think the problem is we don't even know when we're designing applications, we don't even know what cryptography means. So I talk to people and they're like, well, I used AES, and so, I wasn't inventing my own cryptography. And you look at the way they're using AES, and it's problematic.
Right.
So I think, the ignorance is so deep that most of us don't know what we're doing.
Yeah.
Enough to know we don't know.
Yeah, and I feel like the idea of you must consult a real cryptographer is saying, like, you have to go talk to Gandalf to figure out how to do your project, right? Or how to do this safely. And, like,
yeah, you guys, most of us don't know a cryptographer.
Yeah, like, Gandalf and Saruman, like, they're gone, man. Like, we got to do it for ourselves now. The elves are gone. We're all that's left. It's hobbits and people.
So in terms of where to get started on this path, there's a couple resources I really highly recommend. The first is Lawrence Van Houten, who is a member of the Python community and also a real cryptographer, gave a talk last year at PyCon, Cryptography 101, mm-hmm. that I highly recommend. The video and the slides are online. And he's also writing a book based on that. So I think you can get the beta version of the book somewhere on GitHub. So that's one place I recommend starting. I also recommend basically reading everything Colin Percival, who's a cryptographer and was the FreeBSD security officer for a while, everything he's written. He's got a talk, I believe it's titled Cryptographic Right Answers for Developers, which sort of lets you know what you're supposed to be using. There's a companion blog post as well. I also recommend Thomas Ptasek. He's written quite a bit, including a blog post, which you can only find like on Google Cache for some reason, but there's a really good blog post by him titled You Should Never Type the Letters AES that I recommend. And also Moxie Marlinspike, who's the author of an application called Text Secure, which is encrypted like text messaging and messaging for phones. He's also written quite a bit on his blog post of material I think is really good.
Okay, awesome.
What I'd add to that list is Practical Cryptography, which is more of an architectural level stuff by Niels Bergesen and Bruce Schneier, I think.
Okay.
That's the second book, right?
Yeah, so not Applied Cryptography, because that pushes you towards typing the letters AES, which is a really bad idea. Practical Cryptography is kind of more the follow-up of the first one. Is more a textbook of how to do the mathematical side of crypto.
Yeah, okay.
Practical Cryptography is more about, at an architectural level, how to incorporate crypto into a larger system on the assumption you have non-broken crypto primitives to play with. One I would actually recommend, despite the issues with the NSA, the NIST standards and recommendations are actually really readable and really good. So there are some excellent descriptions of CVC Mac and all sorts of other stuff that, as Alex says, you don't want to write your own, but understanding what they are, what they're for, what the recommended uses are, the NIST stuff is actually really good.
Alex, I also want to give you a shout out for the awesome new podcast that you're doing with Kenneth Reitz, Import
Thank
This.
You.
Just had your first episode come out. I listened to it the other day. Good stuff. I'm looking forward to hearing more. So
thank you.
Welcome to being podcasting for realsies all over the place. Yay.
Nick, I know that we made it a wrap tonight for Python 3, but I kind of feel like a jerk for how I worded an earlier question. And as an apology, I would like to reword it and ask you, could a commercial operation feel good about embracing Python 3 kind of as their language of choice and using 3? Like they're looking to pick a language. Could they feel good about picking it going forward?
Absolutely, because our goal for Python is to make it as ubiquitous in computing education as Java is. The pool of professional Python developers globally, the aim is for that to swamp Java. That if you scratch not just professional developers, but scientists, lawyers, accountants, I want Python to be an assumed business skill. That is the scale of my ambition.
Aiming low.
Just, yeah.
Modest goals.
Awesome. Thank you.
All right. So it's come to the time when I say those two very scary words, Python trivia. Everybody ready to play? We'll see how we do here.
I read the answers. Can I play?
Maybe if... Let's give our guests a shot first, all right?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So speaking of blowing your foot off with loaded weapons, what popular TV series features a cult python?
Hang on, what? I don't think I understand the question.
Okay, so there's a popular TV series that features...
Running now?
Yes, right? Well, yep. I don't know. Is it on now? It's not. I mean, it's still ongoing. It's not off yet. I actually fell out of love with it, so I have not been watching it lately.
I did not.
But there's a very prominently featured handgun in that happens to be the Colt Python. And so the question is, can you name the TV series?
It's on tomorrow night.
We've got to watch enough TV.
I'm trying to whisper, it's on tomorrow night. Except for you, Nick, it's probably on right now. Or in a few hours, actually.
And think of all, for all of our listeners who are catching this days, weeks, or months, or possibly even years later, tomorrow night will be a very wibbly-wobbly concept.
It will be Sunday night.
There might be zombies.
I have no idea. The Walking Dead.
Hey!
Yay!
That is correct. Yeah, Rick's handgun is a Colt Python. So now you know, knowing is half the battle.
I haven't seen the show. I have seen the Mythbusters episode.
Yeah, Mythbusters episode was great, wasn't it?
That was
all right.
Very cool.
Question number two. In what European country can you ride the Python roller coaster?
France.
That is incorrect.
I'll try Germany.
That is also incorrect.
Dave? Yeah, I'm just naming a random European country.
So I find this fascinating. It is the Netherlands, and it makes me wonder, is that a coincidence?
That is pretty cool.
All right, so you can ride the Python roller coaster there. Maybe when people go for EuroPython sometime, they can go check that out.
I don't know why, but it sounds like something that would happen or you would say during drinking, and I don't know what that means.
Okay, now back to actually something that might be a little easier for us. Our final question, what Monty Python sketch provided a name for Python's package index?
The cheese shop.
Yes, points to both of you. Hooray. For bonus points, do you know the Weird Al song that parodies that sketch?
Nope.
Well, everybody should go listen to it, because it's great. It's called Albuquerque, and it has almost the same scene, but in a donut shop.
Oh, I do have a copy of Albuquerque. I've never made the connection before, though.
It's good for annoying your family on road trips. I like that song a lot. All right, so another resounding success of Python trivia. I think we've got pretty much an even tie, and some debate in my head about whether I should keep trying to do this or not. Oh, well.
Awesome.
All right, well, we are going to, I think, wrap up for this evening. Thank you both, Nick and Alex, for joining us. Thank you for your insights and discussion, and look forward to all the awesome new things coming in Python's 3 or 2.8 or cryptographically signed, sealed, and delivered.
Yeah, thanks, guys. This was awesome.
Thanks for having us, guys.
And hopefully I will run into some of you at PyCon in Montreal.
PyCon!
From Python Import Podcast is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 3.0 license. Yummy. Our hosting is made possible by a donation from Rackspace. Learn more about them at rackspace.com. Our theme music is Code Monkey by Jonathan Colton. To learn more, visit his website at jonathancolton.com. You want to catch up on previous episodes? Subscribe so you never miss a thing? Want to drop us a line? It's easy. Just visit our website at frompythonimportpodcast.com. Thanks for listening.
Code Monkey like Fritos. Code Monkey like Tab and Mountain Dew. Code Monkey, very simple man. Big warm fuzzy secret heart. Code Monkey like you. Code Monkey like you.
Sometimes you just gotta rock out, man.